the best of our knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, for five centuries, the world has benefited from the artistic and scientific contributions from Leonardo da Vinci. The touring exhibit brings the Renaissance polymath's ideas to life. We'll go behind the scenes at America's largest theater company for young people, and it's time for students preparing for college to fill out their federal student aid applications. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Leonardo da Vinci did it all. The Italian polymath was a painter, cartographer, astronomer, and inventor. Da Vinci designed bridges, flying machines, weapons of war, and people-powered vehicles in the 15th and 16th centuries. His lifetime of work contributed to mathematics, engineering, fine art, chemistry, geology. The list goes on and on. But it's one thing to read about Da Vinci's inventions in a book, and another thing to see his machines in person. A project of Evergreen Exhibitions, Leonardo da Vinci, Machines in Motion, recreates 40 machines from Da Vinci's notebooks. I had the chance to catch the exhibit as it was being installed at MISci, the Museum of Innovation and Science in Schenectady, New York. I spoke with exhibit technician Evan Barber.
Leonardo da Vinci Machines in Motion was developed by some artists and artisans in Italy, and Evergreen Exhibitions simply tours the show. But the concept of it is taking Leonardo's drawings that he made for a variety of machines, machines of earth, machines of air, machines of water, and machines of fire, including some machines developed for warfare. And they're all basically constructed out of wood as though they were made in the time of the Renaissance. It's an interactive exhibit, so the public can manipulate these machines and understand some of the basic physics that were employed at the time to develop these really ingenious machines.
So let's go over here, and I'm looking up at the ceiling, and there's a few large wings. One has fabric and one does not. What are these? And these, are, I'm imagining, are scale models of Da Vinci machines.
Yeah, and you can see from this one, which is called a fixed-wing ornithopter, and the man that will be hanging from it, it's not fully installed yet, is essentially life-size. And these are all flying machines. This is a bicycle ornithopter. And we have a parachute over here, and we have a theater bird. And what is under construction is a fixed-wing ornithopter. And the public will be able to look at a graphic that comes with it, see the drawing, and understand, oh, this is the concept behind it. You know, the fixed-wing ornithopter is essentially a hang glider. But all of this was developed, you know, hundreds of years before the Wright brothers. So the foresight that he had is really incredible. And you can really see that, wow, he had these brilliant ideas long before sort of modern science kind of conceived of them.
Right. So Da Vinci was thinking about human flight hundreds of years before Kitty Hawk.
Right.
What can you tell me about this large tank that's being assembled in the middle of the floor right now?
This is an armored car. It's essentially a revolving, what we call tank these days, long before the modern tank was developed. And you see there are holes for cannons, and the whole thing can rotate around. The public will be able to enter it and understand how this would have worked. When you come in, it's going to essentially look like a domicile, like a yurt, but the whole thing could travel and move around and rotate.
It's people-powered.
Everything is people-powered, yeah.
Over here, there's what looks like a millstone or a grindstone. Can you tell me what this exhibit
is? This is for grinding a mirror. Later lenses, which would be used in things like telescopes. So it simply looks like a whetstone, but the glass would be underneath, and it could be, this whetstone would be turned, rotated, so that it would grind away and create a convex surface for the mirror.
Oh, yeah, so the glass would sit, or the metal, what would sit on the bottom in this tray here?
I'm not entirely sure, but I believe it would be glass for the mirror.
Glass. Yeah. Sure. And then over here, we have, well, this looks like a crane.
Yeah, these are various machines that operate on basic physics to move things. You know, this is before we had machines like tractors. So again, as you said, everything is people powered, but how do you move large loads? How do you turn rotary motion into a lifting up and down motion? So a lot of these machines deal with that. Here we have an air meter, wind and water meter. We have a double mover. We have some basic ball bearings.
And these can be interacted with the public,
yeah,
too?
Yeah, they can generally turn a handle, spin something, see how it would work. So I think it ties in well with the rest of this museum, because you're talking about basic physics principles. We could have educators come and share, like, oh, this is something you're learning in school, and this is how it could apply here.
Now, as a technician who's been traveling and setting these up, have you learned a bit about physics yourself just from assembling these
machines? I think I have, yeah, certainly.
And I want to look at this one over here.
Yeah.
This is a saw.
This is a saw. It's essentially a band saw that is hand cranked, but as you see, there are four blades, so it can take a log and cut it into four strips that you could use for decking or planks to build any kind of structure with.
And there's a log, it's like a half of a log in there, and
yeah,
from where it's set, it looks like it's cutting 2x4s.
Essentially, yeah. So you can imagine how much faster this would take to build something rather than cutting each one by hand.
So I just asked you the question about if you've learned anything from setting these up, but from seeing the machines themselves, I mean, what do you think of this and really rediscovering this technology? What do you think people get out of these exhibits when they come see them?
Well, I think everyone knows who Leonardo da Vinci was. He's a painter, but you don't really get a really hands-on idea of the genius of the man until you see all of these really tactile and concrete examples of his work. And then you can understand both a bit about him and a bit about the time period he was in. We take a lot of this stuff for granted with all of our modern technology. You know, we can push a button and a lift will lift something for us electronically. But here, everything had to be built by hand in order to move things, to measure things, to fly through the air. And so I think the public will really get a much clearer idea of the context Leonardo da Vinci lived in and the history of the time.
Evan Barber is an exhibit technician with Evergreen Exhibitions, whose traveling exhibit, Leonardo da Vinci, Machines in Motion, is on display this summer at the Museum of Innovation and Science in Schenectady, New York. At a museum dedicated to discovery, learning, and creativity, MySci President and CEO Gina Gould said the exhibit promotes STEAM for kids of all ages.
We rent a nationally traveling exhibit every summer that is family friendly, because for us to create our own exhibits, it's a lot of work and a lot of money every year. And it's nice to bring in something different that isn't always attached to our collections. And to bring in an exhibit like Da Vinci, it is the perfect meld of art and science. It's STEAM, because in order for this Da Vinci to have designed all this, he had to understand math. He had to understand a little bit of physics. He had to understand geometry and spatial stuff, and he was a creative. And I believe in my heart that all engineers and scientists are creatives. They create beautiful things in their minds, and then they work with artists to actually make them real for the general public. So this is a great example of that.
Gina Gould is president and CEO of MySci in Schenectady, which is hosting the traveling exhibit Leonardo da Vinci Machines in Motion this summer. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. The Children's Theater Company in Minneapolis is the largest and one of the most acclaimed theaters for young people in the country. Serving audiences of over 250,000 annually, the Tony Award-winning theater company says it aims to create experiences that educate, challenge, and inspire. With the final show of the season now running through June, CTC's production crew is beginning to plan for the upcoming fall lineup. Keeping the theater in operation and the shows coming takes a team effort. To learn more about how CTC operates on stage and behind the curtain, The Best of Our Knowledge's Jody Cowan spoke with Michelle Lancey, a painter, dyer, and crafts artisan.
When I'm working as a painter dyer, I will create pieces based on what the designer wants. But then there's a whole phase that we go through after rehearsals before opening night, and that's called tech. And so that's when lighting and sound and costumes and all the departments get together and watch what's happening on stage, and we get it right before the show opens. So I may have painted and dyed fabric that has now been turned into a costume, and it's on stage, and the lighting might be really bright. So I would have to take the garment and either tone it down or change the color and just sort of work in collaboration with everyone else to make sure that everything looks perfect once it's on stage.
You mentioned your use of fabrics. What other materials and techniques do you generally work with? Are there any must-have supplies that you always go to?
I do a lot of distressing. So if a show needs people to be in garments that look tattered or sort of roughed up or just sort of lived in and not right off the rack, the techniques I might use, they can involve anything from sandpaper to spraying, airbrushing, sponging. Acrylic paint is water-based. It can be thinned out so it can go into a spray bottle. It can be used with mediums that make it a little more plasticized. It can be used straight out of the tubes. It can be used on shoes, fabrics. When it's used on fabrics, it gets heat set. Oftentimes, when it's used on shoes, it'll get a clear coat over it. We do a lot of retouching, though, when it comes to shoes and other pieces that might get sort of tossed around or banged into things throughout the course of the run. We will do some retouching as needed.
This current season is winding down ahead of an exciting lineup that includes Circus on Stage, an adapted graphic novel, and a couple of franchise favorites from Dr. Seuss and Disney. Do you tend to work on multiple shows simultaneously or approach them one at a time?
It's sort of 50-50 with that. Right now, we know the names of the shows. We know that we have a circus type of show that's coming in first. So that gives us time to get reacclimated when we do come back. Right now we're on summer break. When we come back in August, we will mostly be focusing on the Curtain Call Ball, which is a one-night event where it's just a very extravagant party. And we do a lot of fundraising that night, silent auctions. There's many performances happening. There's a great dinner. And so that sort of sets the pace for us to get back in the mood of creating. Once that night is over with, we have a show that is brought in. So that also gives us about a month to 6 weeks time to start working on our first show. And our first show usually is a smaller production that is brought in by a designer, a director, a playwright, and we work with all of them up front getting their vision down. So there's a lot of meetings, a lot of notes that take place. And then once that happens, the craft and costume team works directly with the designer who will be in probably, you know, 4 days a week, working alongside, telling us whether we're going in the right direction, helping us source materials. Sometimes there's a lot of beading. There might be a lot of things that you would see in a craft store, chain, beads, paints, clays, foams, all different types of elements that can be added to a project to make the designer's vision come to life.
Do materials tend to get used multiple times across different shows? Like, would a backdrop painted for one show end up flipped and repurposed for another?
I can't really speak to scenic, but I do think that most of the pieces that are used for backdrops and scenery are pretty much isolated to the theme of the show that they were created for. As far as costumes go, certain shows have a look that could not be crossed over into another show theme, like How the Grinch Stole Christmas. Those costumes are very specific to that show. However, there are many shows that are modern, and we can go to the warehouse and look around, see what we have there, pull costumes that are in sort of a generic category, and then we will alter them. Or sometimes, you know, if it's just a simple suit, we can use them as is. But we have a lot on hand at all times. We have ties, gloves, shoes, hats, all sorts of things on hand that we can just reach for and change the look of them when needed.
How did this last season go? And were there any standout moments for you?
It was an amazing season. It really was. Frog and Toad is on stage now through June. And that was a show that actually went to Broadway. And it's been very well received all the times that we have put it on stage. Same with Alice in Wonderland, but we hadn't done that in many years. That was our show that opened the beginning of this year. And it was a great show. The designer had passed away, so we still had costumes from the first or from the last time it ran, and we did not want to reinvent the wheel. But there were actors, of course, that were in this show that were not in any of the previous productions. So new costumes needed to be created where they weren't exactly fitting the new actors. So we stuck to that designer's vision.
With all theater productions being largely collaborative efforts, where do you see your job in the overall storytelling that happens on stage?
My role is to make sure that whatever is created for the actor is comfortable. The pieces are able to be moved around in with ease. A lot of the shows are very action-packed, which you have to have when you have an audience that's geared toward children. There needs to be, you know, a lot of stimulation happening. So, for example, in the show that we had at the end of 2023 before Grinch opened, it was called Morris Micklewhite and the Tangerine Dress. And we needed to make masks that covered most of the kids' bodies. And so those pieces needed to have headgear on the inside that was much like what would be inside of a helmet. But the piece was very boxy, and it had to be not only stable on their head, but stable on their shoulders. And they danced around in a dream sequence. So these pieces needed to be able to be stable while the kids moved. And it also needed to appear like they were visualizing a dream as they danced around on stage. So I had to use glow-in-the-dark paints because they needed to be seen in the dark and still be colorful. So it was a process where the colors needed to be right, but then they needed to glow as well. And they needed to stay put on the actor as they were dancing around in a dream sequence.
Do you have any words of wisdom for the young folks or maybe the parents of those considering getting into the world of children's theater?
Yeah, I think that if the opportunity is there in whatever area that they're living, I think they should go for it. It helps with socialization, that's for sure, because I think with tablets and, you know, everything that's computerized, gaming, social media, you know, there's a lot of sort of heads in the palm of the hands activity going on. And what I see with the kids that are getting into acting, their social skills are just, they're amazing. And they have a lot to share with each other. Now, a lot of these kids are homeschooled too. So they're not going out there and mingling all day long with, you know, hundreds of other kids at middle schools and high schools. It's a great opportunity for them to meet kids from all areas of life and, you know, just learn from each other while they're learning together.
We've been speaking with Michelle Lancey, painter, dyer, and craft artisan for the Children's Theater Company in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Michelle, thank you for taking the time to speak with us. Any final thoughts?
Create. Just get out there and create. No matter how you do it, whatever your ideas are, get them out there so people can see them and share them.
Michelle Lancey is a painter, dyer, and crafts artisan at the Children's Theater Company in Minneapolis. She spoke with the best of our knowledge's Jody Cowan. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. For high schoolers preparing for college in the fall, now is the time to apply for financial aid. In New York, the chancellor of the state's public university system recently toured public schools to encourage students to submit their FAFSA, or free application for student aid. The Best of Our Knowledge's Samantha Simmons reports on Chancellor John King's visit to Albany High School.
With the school year winding down, Governor Kathy Hochul sent letters to families and school administrators across the state, encouraging students to complete the free application for federal student aid, or FAFSA. The letter informs students and administrators of grants, scholarships, and loan forgiveness opportunities through the state's Higher Education Services Corporation. Deputy Secretary for Education Maria Fernandez says high schools play a role in preparing students for the application process.
It's about economic opportunities. It's about being able to provide our citizens with housing, with education. And so having the universal FAFSA was incredibly important to us. It was something we wanted to ensure that students knew how to fill out. They could get past the difficulties that we've had.
In December 2023, the FAFSA received an overhaul, making it shorter and easier to complete. This was made possible through some information being pulled from tax return documents and the elimination of some questions. SUNY Chancellor John King says students often forgo the application because of a perceived difficulty or lack of resources. Speaking after a roundtable discussion with several students at Albany High School, King says application submissions in the state are down a quarter from last year, likely due to delays caused by changes to the application's format. But King says there has been a double-digit increase in the percentage of submissions nationwide.
When students graduate with a bachelor's degree, they earn more than $1 million more over their lifetime as a result. So we want more New Yorkers to take advantage of these opportunities. Excelsior and TAP together are helping so many of our students attend tuition-free.
King says $200 million in federal aid went unclaimed by New York high schoolers last year, partly because many students in low-income communities don't complete the application, believing even with financial aid, higher education is unaffordable. The average cost for a New York State resident to attend SUNY as of August 2023 is more than $13,500 for commuters and more than $24,500 for students who live on campus. King says it's not only beneficial for students to fill out the application, but it's in the state's economic interest, too.
We know that the student debt crisis nationally is causing folks to delay getting married, to delay starting a business, to put off having children, because they have this albatross of student debt. At SUNY, we've tried to stay affordable.
Schools like Albany High School are working with their students to complete the application by hosting financial aid nights where students and parents can get help filling out the application. Kendall Hunt, a senior, says the simplified application was a breeze.
I was nervous. That's why I came into the FAFSA night at my school. And then they came in. They helped me do it.
In the new state budget, SUNY received a $114 million operating increase. The income threshold for the tuition assistance program was also raised for the first time in nearly 25 years. King says conversations continue with the legislature about how to sustain the SUNY system as costs continue to rise. Reporting for the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Samantha Simmons.
If you'd like to tell the Best of Our Knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to the Best of Our Knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit wamcpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1757. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Jody Cowan. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.